Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. U.S. President Barack Obama is defending the merits of a framework nuclear deal reached with Iran. Mr. Obama said Thursday he is convinced that if the preliminary deal leads to a final comprehensive agreement, it would make the world safer.
This framework would cut off every pathway that Iran could take to develop a nuclear weapon. Iran will face strict limitations on its program, and Iran has also agreed to the most robust and intrusive inspections and transparency regime ever negotiated for any nuclear program in history. So this deal is not based on trust. It's based on unprecedented verification.
Iran, the U.S., and five other major world powers, Britain, China, France, Russia, and Germany, agreed on a framework Thursday in Lausanne, Switzerland, after months of tough negotiations in which success was often in doubt.
I hope that at the end of this process, we will all show that through dialogue and engagement with dignity, we can, in fact, resolve problems, open new horizons, and move forward.
Under the deal, Iran would cut its uranium enrichment program in exchange for relief from sanctions that have badly damaged its economy. Critics of the negotiations, especially Israel, say the U.S. and its partners would be giving Iran too many concessions. The White House says Mr. Obama telephoned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to assure him that the framework in no way diminishes U.S. concerns over Iranian sponsorship of terrorism and threats against Israel. This is VOA News. Kenyans are mourning their dead after a day-long siege by al-Shabaab militants at an eastern university Thursday that left 147 people dead along with four attackers. The Kenyan government is offering a $220,000 reward for another al-Shabaab member in connection with the attacks, Mohamed Kuno, who is already on a government watch list and is wanted for questioning about the attack at Garissa University. Security forces battled the militants for 15 hours and rescued more than 500 students before fatally shooting the attackers. Somalia's President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed said Friday that the killings show the need to eliminate the menace of al-Shabaab from the region. Al-Qaeda militants captured a key Yemeni military base in southern city of Mukalla on Friday, a day after storming a prison there and freeing 300 inmates, including a prominent al-Qaeda figure. Yemeni military officials say the militants faced little resistance in capturing the prison. To the west, the Saudi-led coalition, trying to halt the advance of Houthi Shiite rebels, airdropped weapons to fighters battling the Houthis in the southern port city of Aden. The capture of Aden would mark a major setback for the Saudi-led coalition. China's former security chief was charged Friday with bribery, abuse of power, and disclosing state secrets, authorities said, making him the most senior official prosecuted in decades. Zhou Yongkang, 72, once headed China National Petroleum Corporation and accumulated vast power and wealth as he rose through the ranks to become a member of the Communist Party's elite Politburo Standing Committee, the most powerful body in China. Brief statement on the website of China's top prosecutor's office said Zhou's alleged crimes led to great losses of public funds. It added that his crimes severely damaged national and public interests. French aviation investigators say the first analysis of the second black box from the German wing's flight that crashed in the French Alps last month reinforces the theory that the co-pilot, Andreas Lubitz, crashed the plane deliberately, killing all 150 people aboard. On Thursday, German prosecutors investigating the crash said Lubitz had searched online for information on suicide and cockpit door security in the days before the crash. U.S. employers hired workers at the slowest pace in more than a year in March, with a net gain of only 126,000 jobs. The economic data surprised many economists who had predicted twice as many jobs would be gained. And Russian rescuers continued to search Friday for 13 crew members still missing from the trawler that sank in icy waters near Russia's Kamchatka Peninsula earlier this week. The ship's crew of 132 included 78 Russians. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Yiswuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Iran towards the lecture halls, behind the lecture halls. I stood for a moment, then from there I decided not to go back to the hostel, but to look for somewhere where I can.
That's Kenyan student Kiwanta Anyonga describing the attacks on Garissa University yesterday morning. Details coming up. Also in the news, 6 days after a hard-fought presidential campaign in Nigeria, the national capital in Abuja is relatively peaceful and back to normal. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour: Kenyans are mourning their dead after a day-long siege by Al-Shabaab militants at Garissa University in the eastern part of the country yesterday. The assault left 147 people dead, along with four attackers. The Kenyan government is offering a $220,000 reward for another Al-Shabaab member they believe is behind the attack, Mohamed Mohamud Kuno. The East African newspaper says Inspector General of Police Joseph Bone has announced a dusk-to-dawn curfew for four counties, Garissa, Wajir, Mandera, and Tana River. The curfew begins today at 6:30 p.m. to 6:30 a.m. local time and will last until April 16th. The paper says four or five gunmen attacked the university in Garissa around 5:30 in the morning yesterday. The attackers are said to have worn vested packed with explosives. The Kenyan Defense Forces engaged the terrorists for several hours. At the end of the siege, the gunmen blew themselves up. The East African says rescued students gathered at a KDF camp near the town's airstrip. Here's the account of one student, Kiwanta Anyonga.
I ran behind the lectures. I stood for a moment, then from there I decided not to go back to the hostel, but to look for somewhere where I can hide safely. At around 5 p.m., one of the KDF came, asked us what we were doing there. We said that we were students, that we were hiding from the enemies. So he ordered us to rise up and run towards the gate, of which we did so, towards the gate. Then from there, we were rescued.
Another student told the reporters there had been warnings of an attack on Wednesday, but they were dismissed as an April Fool's joke. Survivors on the Garissa attack said the gunmen singled out non-Muslim students. 24-year-old Suzanne Kitoko broke her hip when she jumped out of a window of her dorm. She could hear the armed men in the next room asking students about their religious backgrounds. One 21-year-old student, Ruben Mowavita, told the press he saw three female students begging for mercy. The mistake they made, he said, was to say, "Jesus, please save us," because that is when they were immediately shot. More details are emerging on the mastermind of the attack, Mohamed Mohamud Kuno. The London-based newspaper, The Independent, says he's been named by authorities as being behind the plot to attack the Kenyan parliament. The paper says he is also listed as being subject to having his assets frozen in the United Kingdom. The paper says Kenyan police investigators believe Kuno and a colleague are also behind attacks on a bus last November in Mandera on the Somali border. That assault killed 28 non-Muslims. The Independent said he is believed to have an extensive terror network with Kenya, particularly at the Dadaab refugee camp. VOA correspondent Gabe Joslow is in Garissa and has this update.
A day after the horror, the Garissa hospital has become the central meeting point for survivors and their families and those seeking answers. Sitting on a shady bench and wearing a hospital gown, second-year student Quinton Anyango says she woke up early Thursday, ready to study in a lecture hall at the Garissa University College. But when she came across several gunmen walking through campus, the day took a horrifying turn.
Oh, I had no hope. I knew that was the end of life. Since I had no option, I had nowhere to go.
Anyango hid with another student in a classroom. Trying to remain still, they could do nothing but listen to the attack as it unfolded in a nearby room.
Just the gunshots, nothing else.
The assault began at dawn when Al-Shabaab assailants stormed the university gate, killing two guards and proceeding to the residence halls. By the time the attack was over, nearly 16 hours later, 147 people were killed, more than twice the death toll in the 2013 siege on the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, also blamed on the Al-Qaeda-linked militant group. The Kenyan Defense Forces, which battled against the militants from the start of the attack, maintained a heavy presence in Garissa on Friday. But residents of Garissa, a dusty town about 200 kilometers from the Somali border, have long called for better security following a spate of small-scale gun and grenade attacks in recent years. Harrison Ambore, a teacher at a Garissa school, says security forces here even ignored recent government warnings of an impending attack.
Yes, there was a warning that terror may take place after somehow 3 days. And it's like this security agency did not take it serious until it now. It happened yesterday. It's when they're now reacting after things has gone wrong.
Some survivors say the gunmen tried to single out Christian students while sparing Muslims, but others say the assailants were anything but precise in their killing. One survivor, an employee at the university who asked not to be named, said he was performing his ablutions, ritual washing, outside the mosque ahead of morning prayers when the gunmen entered the campus.
I heard them saying, everybody should lie down, lie down, lie down.
He says they began firing indiscriminately and that he knew Muslims who were among the dead. The employee also says he thanks the Kenyan military for eventually rescuing him and the other survivors, even though he still suffers the pain of loss.
Personally, I know all those students. As we're speaking, I feel crying even. But I ask my brothers who lost their lives, God bless your soul.
Meantime, Al-Shabaab has vowed to continue attacking Kenya for the presence of its troops in Somalia. The Islamist militant group named no targets, but it is likely that towns like Garissa are firmly in the crosshairs. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Garissa, Kenya.
One medical group that's active in tending to the survivors is the Red Cross. Reporter Douglas Mpuga reached the group's spokeswoman in Kenya, Arnolda Shindu, for an update on the Garissa attacks.
Well, the latest is that, the operation, as far what Kenya Red Cross has been doing today, our focus has been on the recovery, sorting and transportation of the bodies. So everything we've been sending our planes back and forth from Nairobi to go and pick up the bodies and bring the bodies back, and that's been the focus of our operation.
And how are you taking care of the casualties?
The casualties, we took them to Garissa Hospital as of yesterday. The ones who needed intensive treatment, we flew 5 patients to Nairobi last night. They came to get treatment. They went to Kenyatta National Hospital. And then the others are being treated at Garissa Hospital. Now, the reason why we airlifted some, those 5, was because they could not get the necessary treatment in Garissa, but then they could get the treatment in Nairobi.
For those who survived, what kind of injuries are you finding?
The injuries we are finding are a lot of gunshots, gunshot injuries, and then we are finding a few cuts sustained when some of the victims, were trying to escape.
Are there still some bodies at the campus?
I don't have that information right now, so I think I would be commenting out of turn if I said anything about that. I don't know.
And the parents and relatives of the victims, have they been able to identify their relatives?
Well, what we have is we have a tracing desk that we have been putting up at Garissa Hospital as of yesterday. We have another tracing desk here in Chiromo, and we have tracing hotline. So what we're doing is we're working very closely with the families. They come. We're encouraging families in Garissa to come to our tracing desk at the hospital, and the ones who are in Nairobi or who are not, in Garissa can call our tracing hotline. And we are now working throughout the night and throughout the day to, give information to parents based on the records that we have.
And lastly, how is the Red Cross helping with the grieving parents and relatives?
Red Cross, what we have is actually right now at Chiromo, We have a couple of counseling, you know, mobile counseling centers that we set up. So we have all our counselors giving psychosocial treatment, both to the victims in Garissa and to the families here, especially the ones who have gone to identify their loved ones. So, you know, of course, we're providing that support continuously, and, you know, whatever is needed from us, we will provide it.
Red Cross spokeswoman Arnolda Shindu in Nairobi. She was speaking with VOA reporter Douglas Mpuga. Six days after a hard-fought presidential campaign in Nigeria, the nation's capital in Abuja is relatively peaceful and back to normal. Shops are open, traffic jams are back, opposition supporters are celebrating, and President-elect Muhammadu Buhari is ready to take office at the end of May. VOA's Peter Cloti in Abuja talks to David Arnold about the aftermath of an important African election.
Yes, things are pretty quiet now. Tension has significantly eased. But now the incoming opposition party, the People's Democratic Party, or PDP, is planning to legally challenge the outcome of the presidential election that was held on March 28. The party claims there were voter irregularities in parts of the north, including Katsina and Kaduna. So that is the plan at the moment. However, the chairman of the party says they took a big lesson out of this presidential defeat, and that they are putting measures in place to beat back the effort of the All Progressive Congress in the gubernatorial election scheduled for April 11.
What are the specific concerns they have about the voting in the north?
Well, they said they were underage voting. The card reader that was supposed to have played the system did not, were not used in the north, and that it appears that there were some figures that did not tally with those accredited. You know, those accredited should match with those who voted, but there were discrepancies. They said there were more people who voted than those who were accredited, and that was the process. So those were some of the concerns that they were expressing. So however, it remains to be seen if that will be successful, because incoming President Buhari will be sworn in at the end of May. I spoke with the chairman of the Independent National Electoral Commission, Professor Jiga, who says that the card reader, he believes, is here to stay because it injects credibility and transparency in the entire system, and that he is not willing to remain as the head of the Electoral Commission when his tenure ends in June.
Others have said that this is a historic election. There are two viable parties in Nigeria now. Is this important for African politics?
I think so. However, there were 14 presidential aspirants in all that participated in this March 28 presidential election. However, they were too small to cause any significant impact in the outcome. However, it's becoming more of a trend now where a lot of countries that are practicing democracy right now have two main parties, the ruling party and the main opposition party. And this time around, those so-called minor parties try to coalesce around the biggest opposition party to challenge the ruling party. So I think it is a trend that is, it's a trend at this moment in Africa. But a lot of people wish that that could remain, because then voters would have, a clear choice to choose between the ruling party and the opposition, and to determine which party they think can best address their concerns.
What was it like covering this election?
Well, it was interesting, let me put it that way, because you had two main opposing challenges, the ruling party and the opposition party, and you know, once they know that you're here to cover the election, they want their side of the story to be heard. And we did that to create a balance and to ensure that our coverage was beyond reproach. So that's what we did here, you know, in Abuja especially. A number of people from Buhari's camp died while celebrating his victory. They were in cars and, you know, they're just jubilating. Usually when they are celebrating, they stand on top of cars. They, you know, do all kinds of things in their celebrations. Buhari, at that time, when he received his certificate, called for a moment of silence to remember those who perished.
Anything you would like to add?
So far, so good. Things are pretty getting back to normal. I was at the market yesterday, and before then, before the election, you know, all the stalls were shut. Nobody was in there because people feared there could be violence. But after the election, after INEC declared the winner, things have become normal. Traffic jams in the market is back as usual. So things are really getting back to normal here in Abuja.
Peter Cloti in Abuja, concluding his reporting on Nigeria's game-changing election in an interview with David Arnold in our Washington studios. Many Nigerian refugees now living in Cameroon say they expect their new president-elect, Muhammadu Buhari, to end the Boko Haram insurgency soon after he takes office so they can return home. Cameroon is host to some 200,000 Nigerians who fled Boko Haram terrorist attacks. As Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, these Nigerians did not have an opportunity to vote in March 28 elections, but have great hopes for the future.
42-year-old Chidi Lucas fled violence in the northeastern Nigerian town of Ngoshe in the middle of last year and is now an electronic repairman in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. He regrets he didn't get to vote, but says he accepts the outcome, even though his candidate, President Goodluck Jonathan, was defeated.
He has done a lot in Nigeria, like in good roads, many things, improvement. Nigeria came out as the first economic country in Africa. We have never been in that position since. Since Goodluck Jonathan took power in Nigeria, there's no first scarcity in Nigeria. But it is democracy. Buhari has taken over. We support him. Even Goodluck Jonathan has already congratulated him.
Chidi says Mr. Jonathan lost votes because of his inability to stop 6 years of Boko Haram terrorism. He says his wish now is for his successor, Muhammadu Buhari, to capitalize on the recent gains made by the new regional military force deployed against Boko Haram and bring back home people like him who want to participate in the development of their country.
Boko Haram has been in Nigeria since. Cameroon government, Chadian government, and Niger government put hand in fighting Boko Haram. That is why there's progress in fighting them. As Buhari is taking over now, he will continue where Goodluck Jonathan has left. The Boko Harams have no power again as they have before.
For others, the thought of going home is too painful. Aissatou Jowell, a 32-year-old refugee from Gwoza, says even if Buhari does manage to eradicate Boko Haram, she is too traumatized to return. She says her husband was killed in front of their children for refusing to give money to Boko Haram fighters, and to go back, the memories will be unbearable. But she hopes that Boko Haram massacres will be ended so that others will not have to experience her pain. Emmanuel Odimere, who has taken in 3 relatives who fled Boko Haram fighting, says she will be watching for Mr. Buhari to keep his promises.
It was God's will that Buhari should win. What I expect of him is a peaceful Nigeria and not trying to Islamize the whole country. You know, since Buhari said if he climbs, Boko Haram will stop, we're expecting that from him. Since he has given his word that he can do so, let him show his capacity.
Cameroon-born political analyst Professor Ngolengole Elvis says Nigerians see their future in Buhari's hands.
But what matters here is that Buhari have to know that many Nigerians would want to be seen as a people, the number one country in Africa, the number one economy. They should fight the Boko Haram insurgency. In fact, Muhammadu Buhari understand that in Africa, if they fail. They have failed Africa. And I think Nigerians would like to go down as the shining light of Africa, the torchlight of Africa. And I believe that this time around, they will do it.
Muhammadu Buhari will be inaugurated on May 29th with the world watching. Beginning May 30th, his people will be watching with great expectations. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde.
25 past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he and his security cabinet are united in their opposition to the framework agreement on Iran's nuclear program that was announced yesterday night. VOA's Scott Bob reports from Jerusalem.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu convened his security ministers after telling U.S. President Barack Obama in a telephone call that the framework agreement with Iran threatens Israel's existence. Mr. Netanyahu said in a statement that the agreement poses a grave danger to Israel, the region, and the world because it would bolster Iran's economy, increase its aggression in the region, and raise the risk of a nuclear arms race and war. The agreement, reached after 8 days of intense negotiations between Iran and six world powers, sets the guidelines for a final accord by the end of June. It calls for easing international sanctions against Iran as Tehran reduces its uranium enrichment program, which it is feared is being used to develop nuclear weapons. An analyst with Israel's Institute for National Security Studies, Ephraim Kam, said the agreement has some positive aspects, but these are far outweighed by the negatives.
The Iranian nuclear program stopped for some time, and in a sense it was pushed backward. On the other hand, there are many holes in this agreement, which should be a matter of concern for almost everybody.
Critics say the agreement allows Iran to maintain all of its nuclear facilities, which it could quickly reactivate if it so chooses. They say the agreement also does not address Iran's reported program to weaponize its enriched uranium and develop missiles that could deliver nuclear weapons thousands of kilometers away. Professor Eli Karman of Israel's Interdisciplinary Center says the agreement legalizes Iran's nuclear program and does not address its involvement in the conflicts in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen.
Under this kind of legitimacy on the one hand and the potential nuclear umbrella, Iran continues and probably will enhance its aggressive attempt of hegemonic presence in the region. So clearly the Israeli leaders, they are very worried for the future.
Israeli leaders have said they reserve the right to respond unilaterally to any Iranian nuclear threat, including bombing Iranian nuclear facilities. Analyst Karman, however, believes the military option is no longer likely.
The political decision in this scenario, when there is an agreement sponsored by all the big powers in the world, it will make, I think, the military option very, very difficult.
Kam agrees, saying this leaves Israel with very few courses of action.
So what is left is diplomatic efforts using the American Congress and some other friends who might be willing to cooperate. Not very promising options, I would say, at the moment.
Karaman notes that the Iranians may wish to avoid expanding their nuclear capabilities at this time because of a rising confrontation between its allies and a Saudi-led military coalition in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, among other countries.
The Iranians must be very cautious not to provoke the Saudis and even the Egyptians and the Turks, which clearly now are supporting the Saudis in their fight against the Iranian proxies.
Nevertheless, analysts say even tougher negotiations lie ahead as Iran and world powers try to turn the framework agreement into a joint plan of action in the next 3 months. Scott Bob, VOA News, Jerusalem.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
The sounds of Africa, today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Kenyans are mourning their dead after a day-long siege by Al-Shabaab militants at Garissa University. And 6 days after a hard-fought presidential campaign in Nigeria, the nation's capital in Abuja is relatively peaceful and back to normal. Coming up, music from Sierra Leone. And in our feature segment, the last in our series on clean energy successes in Africa. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Friday, Yehiz.
Sonny, I understand a big boxing match tops your sports report.
Yehiz, it's time to climb between the ropes once again with our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moeta. Good evening, Nnamdi.
And a good evening, Sonny.
Nnamdi, we're now less than 1 month away from the fight of the century, Floyd Mayweather versus Manny Pacquiao. Let's go to the training camps, Nnamdi. First, the Pac-Man training in Los Angeles. What's the latest with him?
Well, Sonny, we have what we call rubber dub in camp. Manny Pacquiao dealing with leg cramps. They had to bring in doctors doing a massage and rub. And check this, and they're using a cream worth $1,800 per bottle. For the rub. So he's going through rub-a-dub in camp and, you know, massage and all that, skipping days from running. He's training. He's running right here, a couple of doors from Voice of America Studios in Westwood at UCLA, Drake Stadium.
Interesting.
They have him running up stairs on the stadium, and I'm wondering, he needs the legs. You know, Manny Pacquiao without his legs, like a Lamborghini with no wheels. The easy target for the money man, you know. So he's dealing with this cramp situation, and I've picked in the camp myself a few times. I don't really like what I'm seeing, but it's too early to critique him because people call me Manny Hater, you know. So I'm going to shut up now.
Now, Nnamdi, Pac-Man and Mayweather, I mean, age-wise, they're not spring chickens. Pac-Man 36, Mayweather 38. Are they more susceptible to cramps because of their age?
Sonny, that's a real good point you just brought up. You know, these guys, they've been around for a long time. They've been in camps. They've been doing road work, you know. And the body at the stage will tell you, look, dude, I'm not going to get up for this running at 6 a.m. or 5 a.m. You know, it comes with age. It's a good point. You mean, these guys, they're in their 30s, you know, mid-30s, you know. So pushing the body every time. Manny Pacquiao is at that spot now where this little cramps come fight night. He may just be an easy target for Mayweather.
Mayweather trains and lives in Las Vegas. Nnamdi, what's the latest with the money man?
Money man has been cracking ribs, Sonny, in Vegas, man, dropping guys on the floor. So money man is ready, man. So we are looking at pictures. He's posting pictures on the social media, Instagram. He's happy. He's ready to go. This may be the best of money man we will see because dude is going all the way banking with crazy paper, Sonny. Check this. He's not only the fighter, he's also the promoter. So he's going to get both ends, you know. So by the time all is done, dude is walking away with close to $200 million, man.
Now, in terms of that crazy paper, Nnamdi, if the fight fans want to buy this fight here in the States, what are they going to pay on fight night?
Another good question, Sonny. The biggest so far was when Oscar De La Hoya fought Floyd Mayweather. That's in 2007. You had to pay like $75 to get it. So they call it $74.95, which is when you round it up and add all the state fee and cable TV fee, you're dropping close to $80 or $90. Check this one. For Mayweather, Manny Pacquiao, they sell $99.95. By the time you add all the tax from the state and tax from the cable company here and there, you're dropping $120, man.
Namdi, I read one report where an anti-doping examiner showed up on the Pac-Man's doorsteps. What was that all about?
Well, Sonny, when the fight was made, you know, the board agreed to do what you call an anti-doping test, you know, and this was conducted 4 days after the press conference in L.A. The anti-doping examiner just showed up, said, hey, dude, I need blood and I need urine, you know, so you, no choice, you got to give it up. So that's part of the deal.
Getting back to the finances surrounding this blockbuster bout, Namdi, how come the tickets haven't gone on sale yet?
They're still scaling the house, Sonny. You know, last time we talked about it, we said 70 million, you know. But out of that 70 million, we're talking about a 16,000-seat house in the MGM Grand Casino. And out of this 16,000 seats, you know, the public may only get 1,000. And the question becomes, what happens to 15,000 seats?
Mm.
The 15,000 seat goes to the big boys. The high rollers were flying with their private jet. You don't expect them to be at the nosebleed, Sonny.
They're going to be ringside.
Come on, man, the ringside. Then we're talking, and check this. Bob Arum said today, all these celebrities that are used to getting free tickets to big fights, no free tickets for the Hollywood boys. They have the money. They must pay to be ringside, you know.
In terms of economic impact, how much will Las Vegas, the city itself, make during fight week?
Oh, Sonny, this is really crazy. Let me just give you a simple idea. Before fight week, before the fight was announced, a Motel 6, you're an American, you know what's called a Motel 6. A Motel 6 will run you maybe $125 without the fight week. Right after the fight was announced, that fight weekend, a Motel 6 will run you $350 if you find it.
Then if
you go upscale, you want to be at the MGM Grand or you want to be at Caesar's Palace, dude, you'd be dropping close to $800 to a G for room.
So they're jacking up the prices.
They're jacking up the price. So this fight, the fight weekend alone, will bring in close to $200 million into the city of Las Vegas.
Namdi, let's look ahead to this weekend. The Cameroonian fighter, nicknamed the Scorpion, Saki Obika, back in the ring. Tell us about that.
Sonny, when you have two knockout artists, man, you expect fireworks, you know. Adonis Stevenson, he has 21 knockouts in 26 fights. Our boy from Douala, Cameroon, Saki the Scorpion Bika, he has 21 knockouts in 39 fights. You don't have to be a scientist to figure what's going to happen Saturday afternoon. It's going to be a blowout. And these two guys will clash for the WBC light heavyweight title, and it's going to be on prime time Saturday afternoon, free television. We're talking eyeballs, Sonny.
And in terms of eyeballs, Namdi, I understand a young Ghanaian fighter had some eyeballs looking at him with a victorious outing.
Oh, Sonny, right on time, because it's happening now in America, man. If you want to be in the game, you want to be a big player, you must do it on TV. We have Frederick Lawson, they call him General Okunka from Ghana, from Accra. Check this, 24-0 with 20 big knockouts, Sonny. Recently, he just beat Brady Prescott from Colombia. What this young cat has going for him at the age of 25, he has a big promoter with Deep Pocket and Michael King with King Entertainment, and also Abe Sanchez, who's like top trainer in the U.S., working with him. So he's got it all covered. This is his second TV fight. Dude is on his way at the right time to break into like your CBS, NBC, HBO, Showtime. Dude will be banking.
Show me the money.
Thanks, Namdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moueta. Joining us with their English Premier League football question of the week is the VOA's Tef Tef and Downtown Brown.
Hey, this is VOA's Downtown Brown.
And I'm Tef Tef.
So the question of the week
was a little long. It went something like, over the weekend, Liverpool fans enjoyed an all-star charity match at Anfield. Steven Gerrard was leaving Liverpool, and Jamie Carragher captained respective 11 dream teams. So we said, you know what, let's pick our dream teams this week. And we said, let's just do five players.
You must pick two defenders, two midfielders, and one striker. I picked Tony, who said David Seaman from England, Tef, you picked Maldini from Italy.
Smart guy.
You got Vieira from France.
Zidane from France again.
And then the famous
Pelé. Legendary
Pelé,
yep. That's a good team, except you cheated a little bit by picking Seaman, who's a goalkeeper and not a defender. But it's fine. He's a good goalkeeper, so he can play defense as well.
Yeah, but I mean, Pelé, I think you're the only one that picked Pelé. So
kudos to
kudos to you for picking
that. I think that stuck a little in the modern side of the game.
There you go.
So good job. Actually, the team that I really liked was the one that Adion Prosper picked. He picked, I think, some of the best players. I was kind of...
Yeah.
I would have picked these players had I not picked my other players. But John Terry, Puyol, as defenders, midfielders had Zidane. And Makelele, Zidane keeps coming up. And Ronaldo de Lima, not Cristiano, but the original Ronaldo, who was one of the best players I've ever seen in my life.
And Lewis Brown picked Cannavaro, Carlos Puyol, Gattuso, Michael Ballack, and Shevchenko. Your defense looks really amazing with Carlos Puyol in the back.
That's another big name that keeps coming up. Michael Ballack with the headers is really good. And Shevchenko, of course, AC Milan legend. So let's ask you, Dan.
Oh, you know me.
Last week you started with an easy pick, Ronaldinho.
Very true.
Of course, everybody's going to want to have one of his
team. But here's the thing. I put Ronaldinho as my midfielder, okay?
Okay.
So I'm going to lead up to it. So I got Ronaldinho, my midfielder. Thierry Henry as my midfielder. Carlos Puyol.
Henry's a striker.
I know he's a striker. I know. I'm putting him as a midfielder. I'm putting Thierry Henry as a midfielder. David Luiz as my defender. And Carlos Puyol as my defender. And then the last person I'm going to put in there, come on. There's nothing to say. I'm going to put VOA's Downtown Brown. I'm in that game. You cannot take me out of that game.
I think the coach, whoever it is, will bench you. That's for sure.
And then is my reserve. I got recently retired Landon Donovan. So...
Fair. Shout out to the U.S. national team.
Yeah, I got to give some shout-outs.
All right, cool. Well, I kind of started with Maldini up in the defense and Vidic because, any five-a-side team needs two good defenders so everyone can go forward and attack without worry.
See, you pick Vidic because of Man U. That's the only reason why, though.
I think Vidic is, I've always said this, he is the type of defender, if you cross the bullet, he'll give it a header. He goes for the ball like that. Outside of that, I picked Zidane in the middle as well, and I put Cristiano, who needs some tricks on the field. You need some moves, skills.
Wow.
And in the end, I had to decide between Ruud van Nistelrooy and Henri, and I actually went with Henri this time because he's a more complete striker. I'll admit that, although Ruud always scored so many goals. So that's my dream five.
We thought of this because of the Nike commercial where they transition to different players when they're playing against each other 5-on-5.
Yep.
So matches to watch over the weekend. We got Arsenal versus Liverpool.
That's a good one.
Let's start off with this. I know that's my team playing. I think it's going to be a 2-1 win.
I could go for that, although Liverpool now have a lot to prove. They did not lose easily at Anfield last week, by the way, because they did get a red card at 45 minutes. So they will give you a good test. But personally, I do want to see Liverpool drop some points because that will kind of solidify the top four.
Thing is, you guys are playing against Aston Villa, so I'm going to say it's going to be a 1-1 tie.
Oof. I think this is United's chance to... I think Rooney this week said if they don't beat Aston Villa, their win against Liverpool doesn't mean anything. That's all for this week.
And you can check us out on Facebook.com/VOA Sunny. I'm VOA's Downtown Brown.
And I'm Tef Tef.
Hey, have a great weekend, you guys.
Thanks, guys. And you have a great weekend, too. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yehaeus Wuhee.
Thank you, Sunny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, the last in our series on clean energy successes in Africa. And next, UNESCO launching a press club in South Sudan to support media freedom. But first, some music. Here is Sierra Leone's Fulani with Africa Children.
Fulani future in apocalypse. Smoke. Ella. Black. Get up, yo. Get up. For the children, yo. History. I and I, my brethren, born in Konoko, Newtown, Sepadu, 15 Bangwa, Sri Land of Gold and Diamonds. Me, my mother, Dega, many swear, Papa moved to the city of Freetown. Reset at 45 regions to Bambalato, within another yala, by the bridge, so hungry, at night, long must, Arata, go, it's on number two, though. Hello, they go, but when morning comes, make go feel pain on the me food, though. Hello, African children cries, please stop your crying, keep your head up. African children cries, please stop your crying, keep your head up.
Sierra Leone's Fulani with Africa Children. The Legacy Foundation is teaching thousands of Africans in impoverished urban and rural communities to make biomass briquettes. They're made of the waste from paper, plants, and farmlands and burn longer than charcoal. Those who use these briquettes to cook their food don't need to use wood, so they save Africa's wildlife. This is the last in Darren Taylor's reports on clean energy success in Africa.
Veteran American aid workers Richard and Joyce Stanley established the Legacy Foundation to help people to help themselves. This they're achieving with their biomass briquettes. These are made from a variety of biodegradable materials that burn easily, including grass, straw, and potato and banana peels, says Richard.
It's made with agricultural residues, combustible residues, not human garbage, but agricultural, generally grass, straw, leaves, rice husks, peanut shells. Carboniferous is a fancy word for agricultural material that can be burnt up. When this stuff is ground up and mashed together, it will stick by itself. The fibers kind of interlock like matted hair.
The shredded waste is pounded into objects that look like large donuts. These briquettes burn far longer and much cleaner than charcoal. The foundation has designed metal hand-operated presses that allow producers to churn out a briquette every 30 seconds.
The cost of the briquette is bound up in the kind of machine that's used to produce them. It's almost all labor-intensive, so the faster you make them, the cheaper they get. Briquettes will generally cost between 2.5 and 4 U.S. cents a piece.
Joyce says it's always hard at first to convince people who've always only used wood for cooking that a briquette made from plant waste is a viable alternative.
There is some resistance or skepticism about, will this work? There's always a little bit of, is this really going to work? Is it going to be smoky? Is it going to burn as fast and well as wood?
Mass production allows briquette makers to sell their products. They earn up to $9 a day. Not a fortune, says Richard, but enough to give them an escape from intense poverty. Joyce says some briquette producers have established successful small businesses that have spun off from their briquette making.
Our trainers have businesses, restaurants. They're using briquettes to cook chapatis and nyamachoma and different foods. So,
she says African women are especially good at making briquettes.
They have a PhD in their fingertips, yep, because they have an ability to understand the materials, and that's the most important thing, the understanding of the materials and the hand and the realization of, will this make a good briquette or not?
Joyce says the women are particularly innovative.
The women we work with add recipes, change things, taught us about using eucalyptus to keep away mosquitoes, just are always adding new things to the briquettes. That's made a real-world difference.
But most African societies remain overwhelmingly male-dominated. And Richard says some men get quite upset when women start earning more money than them and become empowered through making briquettes. He recalls a man who became aggressive during a workshop in Tanzania.
He looked at the briquette and he says, Mukufuna nini, what are you doing with this? My toilet paper is this toilet paper.
But he says most briquette producers in Africa, men and women, generally demonstrate remarkable ingenuity. He cites villages in Mali who are using leaves and bark from neem trees to make briquettes. They compress them using cold water. This ensures that the neem material is compacted at a very low temperature.
What happens is that because you kept the temperature down, you retain the aromas. Now you have this wonderful smelling aroma. The neem tree is like a Vicks vapor rub, as we call it, and the aroma comes off without smoke.
He says biomass briquettes, unlike charcoal, don't fill people's homes with polluting carbon smoke. The foundation now has 1,000 projects all over the world, with many being in Africa. But the Stanleys don't want praise for transforming many lives on the continent for the better.
You know, I changed people's lives. They've changed our lives.
Richard says their work is simply to release the potential that already exists in Africa. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
South Sudanese journalists have a new advocate for advancing journalism and arguing the case for a free press. UNESCO recently launched South Sudan Journalism Students Press Club to support media freedom and give budding journalists a new platform. Waki Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Members of the Journalism Students Press Club applaud at the official launch of the organization in Juba. The new club is supported by the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Education Organization, or UNESCO. It's the first of its kind in South Sudan, and students from the University of Juba, Catholic University, Christian University, and Cavendish University have already signed up. Salah Khalid is the UNESCO country representative in South Sudan. Khalid says the ideals of the journalism club are drawn directly from Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which states that everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression to seek and spread information and ideas through any media.
We hope to increase the space for freedom of expression, freedom of information online and offline.
Khalid says one of the key things the club will do is allow UNESCO to support the training of student journalists. He says club members need to improve their writing skills and be educated about laws affecting the media, including those against hate speech and inaccurate reporting.
As I'm saying in every single occasion, freedom comes with responsibility.
Maha Sudik is the chairperson of the Journalism Students Club. She is pursuing a bachelor's degree at the College of Natural Resources and Environmental Studies at the University of Juba. She says she joined the club because it gives members an avenue to voice concerns about challenges on campus.
Through this club, we will be able to address issues which are really, you know, like problems that in within the university and challenges that faces the student in the university. So through the student themselves, because they are the one who really suffered from those problems. And then through writing their articles, we are going like to express it and bring it out to the people so that we can be able to fix it and find the right solution for those problems.
Kenneth Adam is the acting director of quality education at the South Sudan Ministry of Education. He was the guest of honor at the launch of the club. He says UNESCO effort is very timely.
We are at war, and this is really a very good time for you to be able to reflect and to educate the common people who do not understand why are we at war. Peace really is really very important for us to achieve in the country.
Journalists in South Sudan have the right to freely express themselves and gather information under the country's transitional constitution and media laws that were signed last year by President Salva Kiir. Just over 2 years ago, South Sudan became the first pilot country for a United Nations initiative aimed at protecting journalists against the harassment and creating a free and safe environment for them to work in. But in spite of the legal protections and the UN action plan, South Sudanese journalists say their rights have been seriously eroded since the country erupted in violence 15 months ago. Several newspapers have had their print runs seized, and journalists have been detained after running stories that the government disagreed with. Last month, South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwe once again warned journalists not to report the views of rebels fighting the government. Media outlets say that makes it difficult to tell a balanced story. Dut Peter Garang is pursuing his bachelor's in mass communication at Cavendish University. He is specializing in print media. Like other students in the UNESCO Bhakti Club, Garang will have to post the stories he produces on a website run by the students themselves. Garang says that aspect of the club will give him a platform most South Sudanese journalism students lack. He says he also hopes the club will give him the tools he needs to deal with the many threats and challenges faced by South Sudanese journalists.
I cannot stop joining in that because there is insecurity for journalists. I have to get into it and also witness and try to handle to come up with the best solution to it.
For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wodo in Juba.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Bill Barber, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Violent extremism represents one of the most serious challenges to the global community today. Violent extremists seek to exploit our cultural, economic, and religious differences to sow suspicion and mistrust, as well as to recruit and radicalize. But violent extremism is a threat that recognizes no national borders, nor does it choose its victims based on nationality, gender, age, ethnicity, or religion. And because we are all threatened, said Secretary of State John Kerry, we must not accept the extremist narrative that our differences are more significant than our common commitment to ending violent extremism. Violent extremism has claimed lives in every corner of the globe, and Muslim lives most of all. Each of us is threatened, regardless of ethnicity, faith, or homeland. We must demonstrate to the terrorists that rather than divide us, their tactics unite us and strengthen our resolve, said Secretary Kerry.
Whatever one's individual experience might be, there are no grounds of history, religion, ideology, psychology, politics, or economic disadvantage, or personal ambition that will ever justify the killing of children, the kidnapping or rape of teenage girls, or the slaughter of unarmed civilians. These atrocities cannot be rationalized. They cannot be excused.
In late February, President Barack Obama hosted representatives from local and national governments, civil society, and the private sector around the world for a summit in Washington, D.C. Together, these stakeholders discussed not only current violent extremist threats, including ISIL, but also ways to prevent the emergence of violent extremism by addressing its underlying drivers. As Secretary Kerry stressed, we must strengthen the role of civil society, in particular women, youth, and victims, and to ensure that civil society has the space to be able to operate. We need to identify and amplify credible voices, expanding religious and other education that promotes tolerance and peace and respect for all religions. We need to address the social, economic, and political marginalization that is part of this challenge. At the summit's conclusion, delegates pledged to work on a common action agenda that will guide the global community in preventing violent extremism. Participants recognize that only together through a multi-stakeholder approach, not simply through military engagement and not simply through governments, can the international community address this long-term challenge. We are in this for the long haul. We can send a clear signal to the next generation that its future will not be defined by the agenda of the terrorists and the violent ideology that sustains them. We will not cower and we will prevail by working together, said Secretary Kerry. Our collective security depends on our collective response.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.